Come now, begin delving, the bell is on chain. The contest was hard, but a conquest is gained. Let no time be lost, and to get business done, set thousands to work that work down the sun. Oh, it's deep, the desirable work to complete. The whole power learning, the spirit how great. By seven with soon, I've no doubt in me mind. With old Father Ten, shall an intercourse find. So does the race, the canal seems to grow. The vessels accustomed to Bristol to go will soon be deserting Sabrina's fair tide. The shallows and shoals sailors wish to avoid. As freedom I prize and my country respect, I trust not a soul to my toast will object. Success to the plan, not forgetting the spade of plenty and peace, navigation and trade. Begin delving, the bell is obtained. The contest was hard, but a conquest is gained. Let no time be lost, and to get business done, set thousands to work that work down the sun.
Set thousands to work that work down the sun. And so they did. Between them, the Duke of Bridgewater and Brindley, the millwright turned canal engineer, revolutionized inland transport in this country, and in so doing provided considerable impetus for the Industrial Revolution, as well as work for the poor and sound investment for the rich. Well, mainly sound investment, since the age of canal building also had its South Sea bubble moments. Before this mania struck, the writers of the day were busy sowing the seeds for it by heaping praise and good testimony on the builders of the Worthley Canal, completed in 1761.
The canal of the great Duke of Bridgewater, who may justly be called the parent and founder of all similar works in this kingdom, is a very striking instance of public utility, and no doubt the vast fortune which this noble adventurer thus sacrificed for the good of his country, at a time of life when others squander their patrimony in useless dissipation, will amply be repaid.
So reported the Reverend Shaw in 1788. And the following year, an anonymous traveller informed the public,
"'Tis not long since I viewed the artificial curiosities of London, and now have seen the natural wonders of the Peak. But none of them have given me so much pleasure as I now receive in surveying the Duke of Bridgewater's navigation in this country. His projector, the ingenious Mr. Brindley, has indeed made such improvements in this way as are truly astonishing. At Barton Bridge, he has erected a navigable canal in the air, for it is as high as the tops of the trees."
But the grand visions and eloquent words of the canal financiers and engineers would have come to little had it not been for the legions of anonymous canal-digging navvies, whose passage through the country left an indelible mark upon economic and social life during the late 18th and early 19th centuries. Later in the 19th century, these men and their heirs produced a similarly remarkable effect when they helped build the railways. In the early days of canal digging, labour was obtained locally, and over a period of years, an experienced and trained body of men became available for the work. Brindley played an instrumental part in the development of this corps.
Brindley did not want for good men to carry out his plans. He found plenty of labourers in the neighbourhood, accustomed to hard work, who speedily became expert excavators. And though there was at first a lack of skilled carpenters, blacksmiths, and bricklayers, they soon became trained into such under the vigilant eye of so able a master as Brindley was.
Rather than train a new body of workmen for each canal, the engineers often found it easier to employ the established workmen. And eventually a very large, highly mobile, and experienced workforce was at the disposal of the canal builders. These travelling men from Ireland, Scotland, Yorkshire, Lancashire, and so on, expected to earn a good livelihood in return for hard work. Some saved their money and became regular contractors employing their own gangs on the navigation, whilst others, less keen on such hard work, might dream of marrying the boss's daughter.
Oh, when I was young and tender, I left my native home and often to old Scotland I started out to roam. Oh, I started out to roam. Oh, as I wore down through Bishopstown, seeking for employ. Oh, the ganger he knew by me, I was a navvy boy. Oh, I was a navvy boy. As soon as I did get employed, for lodgings I did seek. Oh, it happened to be that very, very night at the ganger's I did a sleep. At the ganger's I did a sleep. Oh, he had one only daughter dear, and I became her joy. For she longed to go and a tramp it with him, her own dear navvy boy, with her own dear navvy boy.
During the late 18th and early 19th centuries, there were thousands of canal navvies, or banditti as they were commonly called, moving about the country. The resultant social upheaval was devastating. The villages and towns they left behind were frequently stripped of their young men, and the places they travelled to were totally unprepared for such influxes of outsiders.
In the making of canals, it is the general custom to employ gangs of hands who travel from one work to another and do nothing else. These banditti, known in some parts of England by the name of navvies or navigators, and in others by that of bankers, are generally the terror of the surrounding country. They are as completely a class by themselves as the gypsies, possessed of all the daring recklessness of the smuggler without any of his redeeming qualities. Their ferocious behaviour can only be equalled by the brutality of their language. From being long known to each other, they in general act in concert and put at defiance any local constabulary force. Consequently, crimes of the most atrocious character are common, and robbery, without any attempt at concealment, has been an everyday occurrence wherever they have been congregated in large numbers.
LeCount, who was closely involved in the planning of the first railways, was attempting to prevent their construction having the same system of employment as the canals. And the evidence of other contemporaries, newspapers and canal company records, shows that his account was by no means wildly exaggerated. The following letter was sent by the Lancaster Canal Company to the contractors, Vickers and Lewis, in July 1795.
I am sorry to be informed that some of your men have been behaving in riotous and very illegal manner at Chorley. Such conduct will bring disgrace upon the works, as well as upon yourselves, and every appearance ought to meet with an immediate and serious check. You will probably be called upon by the justices in the neighbourhood to deliver up the persons who have been guilty, and I would advise you to show the utmost willingness in detecting and bringing them to justice, and be ready to do everything in your power which may be required to satisfy the public for the injury done in thus disturbing the peace and assaulting the public officers. This conduct in you will please the committee, and it is certainly in your own interest to keep your men in proper subjection.
Perhaps it is not surprising that the navvies acted as they did. Their work was fraught with hardship and danger that often resulted in injury and death. And those who did not live in the company hut encampments were often cheated by greedy landladies, or the truck system, where payment for work was made by company note, which could only be redeemed at the company shop, where prices were frequently higher and quality frequently lower than those found on the open market. In spite of the sobering influence of the missionary societies, the social life of the majority of navvies revolved round the public house, and most of their serious crimes, like theft, rape and murder, were perpetrated under the influence of drink. The navvies were ruthless itinerants, resentful of their lack of home comforts, but well paid enough to enjoy to excess the fringe benefits of society, and, by token of their way of life, sufficiently outside the law to ignore the basic responsibilities of community membership. Strangely, there are few songs that mention the everyday routine of the navvies, and to find one that deals wholly with his day-to-day life and attitudes is a rarity.
On Monday morning we make it a rule for every man to choose his own soul. He that comes first may choose all the best, and he who comes last may take all the rest. For that's the rule of the bold navigators, for your jovial banks and all. On Tuesday morning when we go to work, we strip off our jackets and tighten our shirts. We strip off our jackets and let them out free. We drive our poles by 1, 2 and 3. Oh, that's the role of the bold navigators, for your jovial banks and all. It's when that we come to the bottommost run, we fill up our furrows right unto our chin. We fill up our furrows and pile them up high, and if you don't wheel it, another will try.
Oh, that's the rule of the bold navigators, for we are jovial banks men all.
It's when that we come to the main plank wheel, we lower our hands and hold fast to the wheel. For if the plank does bend or go, a ganger on top cries, look out below!
For that's the rule of the bold navigators, for we are jovial banksmen all.
And when we are struck by frost or snow, we'll blow up our mess and off we will go. We'll call our timekeeper without any dam to let us have our time before we go tramp.
Oh, that's the rule of the bold navigators, for we are jovial banksmen all.
When it does begin for to rain, we'll take up our burrows and all gang in. Right into a whiskey shop we will go. We don't give a damn whether we work or no.
Well, that's the rule of the bold navigators, for we are jovial banks and all.
We'll have a gaffer without any damp. We'll not pay his tummy before we go tramp. We'll tell our landlady before we do go that it's not our role to pay what we owe.
That's the role of the bold navigators, for we are jovial banks and all. That's the role of the bold navigators, for we are jovial banks and all.
The navvies were not the only ones who suffered because of their chosen way of life. The engineers who found fame and fortune in their work were frequently beset by illnesses which resulted from their itinerant way of life. Brindley, the first British canal engineer of repute, was no exception. The final chapter of his life is best told in the moving words of his friend and mentor, Josiah Wedgwood, when writing to inform Thomas Bentley of Brindley's death.
To Mr. Thomas Bentley, Little China Row, Chelsea, near London, 28th of September, 1772. My dear friend, I told you in my last letter that Mr. Brindley was extremely ill, and I have the grief to tell you he is now no more. He died the 27th instant, about 12 noon, in a sound sleep. What the public has lost can only be conceived by those who best knew his character and talents, talents to which this age and country are indebted for works that will be the most lasting monuments to his fame, and show to future ages how much good may be done by one single genius when happily employed upon works beneficial to mankind. Mr. Brindley had an excellent constitution, but his mind, too ardently intent upon the execution of the works it had planned, wore down a body at the age of 55, which originally promised to have lasted a century, and might have given him the pleasing expectation of living to see those great works completed for which millions yet unborn will revere and bless his memory. Do I need to tell you that he bore his last illness with that fortitude and strength of mind which characterized all his actions? Your affectionate friend, Josiah Wedgwood.
Whatever the hardships of the itinerant navvies, craftsmen and engineers, and whatever their social problems, the canals were built, and their owners were happy to celebrate with a grand opening befitting the magnificence of the occasion. Those who attended such ceremonies and those who stood idly by to watch the building of the canals were known as gongooslers, or, as De Salis expresses it in his Handbook of Inland Navigation,
idle and inquisitive persons who stand staring for prolonged periods at anything out of the common.
Such canal openings provided the opportunity for prolonged gongoozling on an Olympian scale. Naturally, the navvies got their roasted ox and free beer and were allowed to take part in the festivities before going tramp, that is, looking for their next navigation job. Such were the festivities that marked the opening of the Croydon Canal in October 1809, of which the Times newspaper said,
"On Monday last, the navigation of this canal from the Thames to the town of Croydon was opened. The proprietors met at Sydenham and there embarked on one of the company's barges, which was handsomely decorated with flags, etc. At the moment of this barge moving forward, an excellent band played God Save the King, and a salute of 21 guns was fired. The proprietor's barge advanced, followed by a great many barges, loaded some of them with coal, others with stone, corn, etc., etc. When the proprietors approached the basin at Croydon, they saw it surrounded by many thousands of persons, assembled to greet, with thanks and applause, those by whose patriotic perseverance so important a work had been accomplished. It is impossible to describe adequately the scene which presented itself and the feelings which prevailed when the proprietor's barge was entering the basin, at which instant the band was playing God Save the King, the guns were firing, the bells of the church were ringing, and this immense concourse of delighted persons was hailing by universal and hearty and long-continuing shouts the dawn of their commerce and prosperity."
Long before the general festivities took place, and the canal navvies, encouraged by free ale, had worked themselves into a blissful state of euphoria, the local poets had scribbled out their exultant verses, and the ballad writers had penned their celebratory ditties. In some cases, as on the Croydon Canal, the verses were sung by one of the proprietors, but the writer frequently sang his own composition. A particularly prolific balladeer was John Freeth, the Birmingham coffeehouse owner who wrote many such songs to perform to his customers. When the Birmingham Canal navigation was opened in 1769, John was there with a song at the ready. And perhaps it will be fitting to end this brief excursion into the navvy's world with Freeth's hymn of praise for canals.
"This day for our new navigation, we banish all cares and vexation. The sight of the barges, each on his heart, lads, and the merriest of mortals are Birmingham lads. Birmingham lads, jovial blazon, the merriest of mortals are Birmingham lads. With pride, every heart must be glowing. Stamps, dresses, and lace shall be going. The lads of the wharf with their lasses repair and smile at the streamers that play in the air. Play in the air, free and fair, and smile at the streamers that play in the air. Let Stratford's sons boast out of measure the fruits of their mulberry treasure. Such treasure for once may cause jubilee joys, but riches spring daily from Birmingham toys. Birmingham toys, all men praise, but riches spring daily from Birmingham toys. Seven Trent and the Avon, our countrymen frequently rave on, but none of their neighbours are happy as they, who peaceably dwell on the banks of Moray. Banks of Moray, ever gay, who peaceably dwell on the banks of Moray. Not Europe can match us for traffic, America, Asia, and Africa. Of what we invent, each partakes of a share. For the best of wrought metals is Birmingham ware. Birmingham ware, none so rare. For the best of wrought metals is Birmingham ware.
Once the dust had settled on the canal opening celebrations, the real work began. The bargees and their mates, and later the wives and children of the boatmen, with the aid of a horse, floated up and down the canals carrying coal, iron ore, wood, copper, foodstuffs, hardware, and all manner of goods. Those who operated the canal tolls and the boatmen themselves left a wide variety of jobs for the new life. The companies that owned the canals were usually separate from those that operated the canal carrying business. The canal owners levied tolls of varying amounts depending upon the type of goods, and the carriers charged their customers whatever they thought the market could stand. The canal boatmen practiced various deceptions in order to defraud the company and to supplement their incomes. They would overload boats, cover high-toll cargo with low-toll goods, obtain the connivance of the tollkeepers, and so on. The carriers took various steps to curtail such abuses, and they were quick to prosecute in order to make an example of errant boatmen.
Coventry Canal Navigation. Caution. On Friday the 27th of May instant, Henry Woodward, the steerer of a boat, was brought before the county magistrates at Coventry, charged with endeavouring to evade the toll payable to the Coventry Canal Company in respect of several cases of pipes which he had secreted in his boat laden with roadstone, and was convicted of the offence. This is to give notice that all persons offending in a similar manner will be proceeded against, and the whole penalty of £5 prescribed by the same sued for. And in addition, the whole of the cargo in the boat, although partly consisting of roadstone, will be charged with tonnage. By order, Charles Woodcock, Clerk of the Coventry Canal Company, May the 25th, 1861.
As the 19th century progressed, so the life of the canal folk grew harder. Competition from the railways and the many trade recessions of the early and mid-19th century hit the canal-carrying companies, and, inevitably, wage rates failed to keep pace with cost-of-living increases. Often, particularly on the longer hauls, wives and children had to travel with the boats in order to make the life a paying proposition, and the subsequent social problems caused through overcrowding and poor amenities were considerable. Additionally, like many other workers, the canal folk suffered under the truck system that was so popular with employers. Under this system, the boatmen were paid in full or part by tommy notes, which could only be exchanged at the company-owned shop, or a shop designated by the company. Thus, the boatmen, like the colliers, iron workers, and craft workers, were subject to a singularly destructive payment system. Unlike the colliers, whose reaction was often violent and always militant, and unlike the craft workers, whose reaction tended to be submissive and appealing, the canal folk accepted the situation as a fait accompli. They didn't like it very much, but were not prepared to dwell too heavily on their problems. Thus, the feeling behind the song Tommy Note is at once humorous, permissive, and complaining.
You boatsmen and colliers all come listen to me, ditty. I'll sing you a song before it's long. It is both new and pretty. It is concerning Tommy Shops and the Highfield ruffian. He pays you with a Tommy note, or you must have that or nothing. Oh, the boatsman I now bring in sail from Highfields to Runcan. The boatsman and their wives, they curse him at the junction, and all belonging to the branch that know the art of boating. Wishing the tiller down his throat, it would be a means to choke him. Now when they've done their Runcan voyage and go to receive their money, the one half stops for hay and corn and the other half for Tommy. Then to the Tommy shops we'll go to fetch a week's provision. Our oatmeal, sugar, salt and soap, short weight and little measure. Oh, if we had money instead of this provision, we could have plenty. The profit that they get out of us is 9 shillings out of 20. And then we jump on board the boat and the children look so funny. The voyage we's a cheerful go till we've eaten all our Tommy. Now there is one amongst the rest, he knows the art of boating. He vows and swears a wife he'll have so long he's gone courting. He vows that he will marry, become listen to me joke, sir. And when the parson's done his work, he'll pay him with a Tommy note, sir. Oh, now that we have finished our voyage, the children look so funny. For here at Runcan we do lie, and we bet out all our Tommy. Come gear the horse and clear the line, and jump on board the boat, sir. Both night and day we'll steer our way for another Tommy note, sir.
Of course, the late Victorian period was one that saw an emergence of humanitarian principle and action previously unequalled. Humanity towards pets, children, slaves, even the working man became the order of the day, though, even so, the canal folk in the 1870s still found themselves uncared for by the government legislation that had brought some light to bear upon the dark places of industrial Britain. When their champion did arrive, his crown was clearly in dispute amongst the boat people themselves and amongst his educated peers, many of whom found his self-righteous style rather abrasive. But George Smith of Colville, as he liked to be known, numbered amongst his supporters reformers like Shaftesbury and Edwin Hodder. Smith was certainly a remarkable man. For 13 years, the middle years of his life, when he had a wife and children to support, he lived on handouts whilst battling for recognition of and improvement to conditions under which the canal women and children were forced to live. His entire life after his mid-20s was dedicated to this and similar causes. He achieved positive success in terms of petitioning for government legislation on behalf of the canal people with bills in 1877 and 1884. The second bill was intended to repair the holes in the earlier bill, but its effectiveness was questionable, and some observers felt that Smith, through this legislation, had simply made it impossible for the canal people to earn any kind of living from the canals. His bills promoted such basic observances as:
A. The boat shall contain a cabin or cabins, clean, in good repair, and so constructed as to be capable of being maintained at all times, weatherproof, dry, and clean. B. The interior of any after cabin, intended to be used as a dwelling, shall contain not less than 180 cubic feet of free air space. A cabin occupied as a sleeping place by a husband and wife shall not at any time, while in such occupation, be occupied as a sleeping place by any other person of the female sex above the age of 12 years, or by any other person of the male sex above the age of 14 years.
And so his bills, dearly bought at the cost of many thousands of miles tramping the canal banks, meeting boat families, letter writing and canvassing, came to their majority. But even after the 1884 bill, it was still difficult to control the movements of the boat people and the activities of their employers. times were hard enough, and Smith's bill made it even more difficult to contend with the competition of the railways, particularly when the railway companies often had controlling interest in the canals and could manipulate the tolls and fees in order to reduce the economic effectiveness of canal carriage. There were sad occasions also when canals actually closed down, and the final irony might be the fate suffered by the Carlisle Canal navigation.
Notice is hereby given that by virtue of the provisions of the Port of Carlisle Dock and Railway Act, 1853, the above navigation will be closed on and after the first day of August next, when the water will be run out of the canal for the purpose of converting it into a railway, by order of the Committee of the Carlisle Canal Company, July the 14th, 1853.
The same forces that brought great commercial changes also had an effect on the social activities of the boatmen. Until the early 19th century, they, along with other workers, and in some cases the gentry, had enjoyed the general festivities and sports current in the age: cockfighting, bull baiting, boxing, wrestling, and so on, which took place as part of the wakes as well as individual entertainments. The wakes were once watch services of dedication to departed souls, when the people kept a night vigil in the churchyards to protect the souls from evil. These services gradually degenerated into social festivities, and the entertainers and prostitutes brought their small commerce to the churchyards. These occasions were eventually banished to the marketplaces, where they became the Wakes Week, a week of festivities and entertainments taken without pay, a means of interrupting the weary grind of the industrial round. The boatmen shared in such activities and danced to the pipes and drums along with their fellow workers.
Well, come and gather round and hear me song. I own fiddle and frugal of cocks and bulls and surly bears. Our wakes will soon be fallen. Five fiddles, pipes and organs too, the drums and banners bright, to our town field and we'll repair to keep the wakes all night. With a flaming gin and sparkling wine, bloody porter too, and frothy ale to help us drink the old wakes we call through. And the champions gay in fine array will wrestle a box and run. Such sport and play will mark the day from a rise to set of the summer. The dogs will drink, the sex will drive, the cocks will shot when they come. And the girls of ease, the wakes won't leave, but every man is gone. Hey! And roll and reel back to our arms with empty pockets aching as the sign the wakes are on. Success unto the English wakes, whatever they may be, to the steel port cocks and baited bulls that stir up mirth and glee.
With enlightened social thinking, the crude sports and events of the wakes were made illegal, and the boatmen found their entertainment centering on the public house. Beer was still cheap, company free, and the forces of law and order relatively distant. Dominoes, cards, chat and sing-song became the order of the day, though the canal boatmen's preoccupation with music hall songs indicates that trips to the halls were not uncommon. So perhaps it is fitting to end with one of the boatmen's special favourites, popular at a time when, though trade was going through a difficult period, the boat folk had not conceived that it might be the beginning of the end.
Keep your hands all, that's mine. Keep your hands all, that's mine. You just be careful what you do. That little bit of fancy work, it doesn't belong to you. She's a nice girl, I know, and she squeezes absolutely fine. You can do just what you want with any other fella's wife, but keep your hands off, that's mine. First he lost his heart and married Mabel. He took a trip to the dear old Isle of Wight. tune in anywhere. Couples over there going through a tunnel late at night. Oh, Mabel started giggling in the moonlight. Oh, Percy, do stop kissing me, said she. Percy shouted out, will someone strike a light? There's somebody kissing the wife instead of me. Keep your hands off that night. Keep your hands off that night, you. Just be careful what you do. That little bit of fancy work, she doesn't belong to you. She's a nice girl, I know. And she squeezes absolutely fine. You can do just what you want with any other fella's wife, but keep your hands off that mine.
The boom years for the Canals stretched from the mid-18th century, when songs like the Birmingham Lads were heard frequently, to the mid-19th century, when new canal openings were virtually unknown. After 1850 or so, competition from the railways increased rapidly, and railway ownership or part ownership of canal company shares made it possible for the railways to obtain an unfair advantage over their rivals in the matter of discouraging canal traffic by keeping toll levels high, particularly in the important area around Birmingham. By the same token, the management of railway companies had some say in the amount of renewal and repair work carried out on the canals, as the following extract from the 1909 Government Commission report into the canals shows. This rundown was continuous and effective.
Few improvements and no large extensions of inland waterways, always excepting the Manchester Ship Canal, have been made since 1830. And on the other hand, there have been many deteriorations and even disappearance of canals which once existed. On a few waterways or sections of waterways, favoured by special conditions, combined in two or three cases with enterprising management, traffic has been maintained and even increased. On other waterways it has declined, on some it has virtually disappeared. Considered as a whole, the waterways have no share in the enormous increase of internal transport business which has taken place between the middle of the 19th century and the present time.
The Manchester Ship Canal was, of course, a massive and special exception to the general trend, and its completion in 1894 greatly aided the prosperity of Manchester. The following song probably dates from the 1820s. It was sung by a Mr. Hammond at the Theatre Royal Manchester and reflects the missed opportunities and possibilities that a Manchester Ship Canal would have brought at that date.
Oh, I sing a theme deserving praise, a theme of great renown, sir. The Ship Canal in Manchester, that rich and trading town, sir. I mean to say it once was rich ere these bad times came on, sir. But good times will come back, you know, when these bad times are gone, sir. When are these bad times are gone? In 1825, we were speculating all, sir. We wise folks clubbed together and we made the Ship Canal, sir. I should have said we meant to do, for we'd the scheme laid down, sir, that would have made this Manchester a first-rate seaport town, sir. A first-rate seaport town. Oh, alas, too, for poor Liverpool, she'd surely go to pot, sir. For want of a trade, her folks would starve, her custom house would rot, sir. I'm wrong, they'd not exactly starve, or want for it is true, sir. They might come down to Manchester, we'd find them work to do, sir. We'd find them work to do. Success then unto Manchester, and yoke in all aside, sir. country's pride. That is to say, if speculation can be but kept down, sir, I'm sure we've had enough of that, at least within this town, sir, at least within this town.
The decline in canal carrying continued in marked fashion during the 20th century, but the last great blow to the commercial life of the canals resulted from natural causes. As a result of the incredibly severe weather in January and February of 1963, the remaining fleet of commercial narrowboats was brought to a standstill by heavy icing of the canals. The resulting loss of traffic proved decisive, and at the present time there is very little commercial carrying on the wide network of narrow canals. Much of the lore and song of the boat folk, developed over a period of 200 years or more, has been lost since those who were interested in the boat people were not specifically concerned with recording folk life. But fortunately, writers like L.T.C. Rolt, a recognized expert on canal matters, spent a great deal of time with the canal folk and have made valuable comments on this aspect of their lives.
I recall one memorable evening at a canal pub. It consisted mainly of boatmen and gypsies. It was not long before there was the call for the music, and the melodeon, which most boatmen favoured, was produced. Though none of those present could read a note of music, each of the boatmen took his turn as musician. Each of them, one over 70, performed a step dance, footing it with remarkable agility and sense of rhythm in their heavy hobnailed boots. I may be fated to see the last of the old race of canal boatmen. The traditions, the language, and the stories of the boat people could inevitably die with them. Even if they could be fully recorded, the record could be but a pale shadow of the original.
Since the mid-60s, the government has shown some interest in the state of our canals, and the canals, now the green fingers of the countryside instead of the arteries of industry, have taken on a new lease of life by providing escape routes for industrial workers who no longer wish to run the gauntlet of the holiday traffic jams. Messing about in boats is fast becoming a national pastime. Thus, government comment in a white paper published in 1967 takes on a generally optimistic note regarding the future of the canals.
Pleasure cruising on inland waterways and rivers is no longer a pastime within reach only of the well-to-do. The government welcomes this and believes that in the next few years, more and more people will want to use and be able to afford to use the waterways for spare time relaxation and quiet holidays. Therefore, the government intend, at the outset, to retain for pleasure cruising substantially the existing network available for this purpose. It is thus the government's intention that for the first time, this recreational purpose of the nationalised waterways should be recognised by a public act of Parliament. The government is keen to encourage volunteer effort to develop the amenity network of waterways.
Hence, the government recognised the importance of the various volunteer societies whose brief was to protect and improve the amenity of the waterways. And it is from such bodies that the odd new tradition or song has grown. A good example is the Dudley Tunnel Preservation Society, now the Dudley Tunnel Trust, formed in the early 60s with the express intention of saving the Dudley Tunnel, which had been technically abandoned in 1962. The Trust now runs regular trips through the tunnel, but its main work has been in organising the labour force and conducting the operation of renewal on the tunnel and its basins. In the course of the early years of the society, the members and others composed the song Push Boys Push, which was sung at gatherings and also whilst legging through the tunnel. Since the tunnel has no towpath, propulsion is obtained by lying on the boat's cross members and walking or legging along the roof. The tunnel has a number of interesting features, some of which are mentioned in the song. For example, the Castle Mill is a quarry basin partway through the tunnel. The Cathedral Arch is the point at which a tunnel from the limestone workings joins the main channel. The well is an air hole, and the jail is the point at which the tunnel kinks slightly, making it possible for inexpert boatmen to jam their craft.
Oh, we're going through the tunnel. Push, boys, push.
the bride of Dublin town, and they're trying to close it down. So push, boys, push.
Oh,
push, boys, push. We'll go through Castle Mill. Push, boys, push. Cathedral Arch as well. Push, boys, push. There's no more pressure smell when you pass by the well. So push, boys, push. Going through, push, boys, push, since 1792, push, boys, push, it's a crime and it's a shame that we cannot do the same, so push, boys, push,
oh,
push, boys, push. Don't let your strength fail. Push, boys, push. Cause we're coming to the jail. Push, boys, push. We may get stuck inside. If the boat it is too wide. So push, boys, push.
Oh,
push, boys, push.
I am the tunnel 2 miles long.
Push, boys, push. That's why we sing this song. Push, boys, push. It keeps our spirits high while we cannot see the sky. So push, boys, push.
Oh,
push, boys, push.
I am now, we're coming and I
push, boys, push. Oh, don't you see the sky? Push, boys, push. We'll have a celebration. Now we've sung it to the nation. So push, boys, push.
Oh,
push, boys, push.
Yes.
At this moment, there seems a probability that the commercial carrying life of the canals may be extended and developed. The current concern for energy conservation has increased this probability. But the canals have other sources of revenue and value to the community. They supply water for industry, for the water undertakings, and for firefighting. They are valuable for surface drainage and treated sewage disposal. The towing paths are useful and economic channels for electricity cables, gas pipes, telephone, and other communicating wires and lines. In addition to these, there are the recreational aspects of the canals. They include angling, canoeing, pleasure cruising, towpath walking, and nature conservation. Apart from these significant aspects of contemporary canal life and usage, the canals are also an important link with the traditions and customs of the past. It is natural that we should, to some extent, romanticize the life of the canal people, since we now see their largely extinct way of life as free and easy. Perhaps the qualities we identify with most in the canal life are embodied in The Rosemary, a song written by Peter Dodds of Birmingham. His enthusiasm and love for the canals is evident from his writing. And the song, which concerns a prematurely retired boatman who discovers an old narrowboat, the Rosemary, and takes her on a working trip to London, embodies this romantic ideal. The Bollinder is a Swedish diesel engine, and the Stour, Ume, and Tay are three of the old Clayton line boats. The Stour, incidentally, is now owned by a group of Lancashire folk singers, undoubtedly a hopeful sign for the future of canals and canal music.
Was way down in Brummagem, so I do hear say, a boat by the name of the Rosemary lay. She was clothed up and painted in traditional style, but she hadn't a character for a very long while. Folly roll, a folly ride, don't sing folly roll a day. It's song they're all singing down Brummagem way. Along came a boatman, the old boat to sea. Says he, is a craft that is useful to me. I load her with coal and to London I'll steer, says the boatman to the owner, if I take her from here. Bolly-roll, a bolly-ride, oh, sing a bolly-roll a day. It's a song they're all singing down Brummagem way. The owner said yes, and the boatsman okay. Then into the cabin he went straight away. He lit up in the stove, a cleaner cobwebs and mould, and polished the beam till it shone like fine gold. Folly roll, a folly ride, oh, sing a folly roll a day. It's a song they're all singing down Brummagem way. And he laboured far into the night. Got up in the morning before it was light. Put the rusty glow lamp on the cylinder ahead of it. It's a fine day for boating, the old boatman said it. Folly roll, a folly ride, oh, sing folly roll a day. It's a song they're all singing down Brummagem way. Up the engine, the prayer in his heart. I kicked on the flywheel to see if it start. With a bang like the sound of a 10-pounder gun, the 80-year-old Volland has started to run. Folly roll, folly ride, oh, sing folly roll a day. Song they're all singing down Brummagem way. Counter he stood as the rosemary shook herself free of the mud. With a tear in his eye, says the boatsman, we may get right down the cup before the end of the day. Folly roll, a folly ride, oh, sing a folly roll a day. It's a song they're all singing down Brummagem way. Dark stormy nights round the fall of the year, if the beat of a ball in the distance you hear, it's not Clayton's Tower you may all the time, it's the ghost of that boatsman and the old rosemary. Folly roll, folly ride, oh, sing folly roll a day. It's a song they're all singing down Brummagem way. Folly roll, folly ride, oh, sing a folly.